Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to this re-release of my episode with Abigail Spencer. I wanted to re-release this because Reprisal, which is her new show on Hulu, that has been getting a ton of press and a ton of publicity, at least here in the Los Angeles area. And it's an older episode that some of you may not be aware of or have had the chance to get back to yet if you found the podcast through Maximum Fun, because there are so many hundreds of episodes and a lot of wonderful, wonderful talent to comb through. So I wanted to put this on your radar and have you enjoy it. It's been a few years since we did this recording, but I think she's got a lot of wonderful things to say and a pretty amazing life experience. So enjoy the episode. Very exciting, because this is where we've got a reunion of the final two.
Oh my gosh. So much tension in the room.
There's a lot of tension in the room. Principally has nothing to do with me wanting to have won Mark's heart.
No, you just want me.
Yeah. Memory serves. I think my character was gay. But
you're staring me down. You're making me feel really uncomfortable.
I'm very sorry. I don't know. I should have taken a cold shower before you got here, I guess. I'm not sure how I could have better managed this, but we are already in too deep. Abigail Spencer, welcome.
Thank you, Janet, for
sitting down with me on this fine Saturday morning.
Oh my gosh. How could I not want to sit in this amazing room with all of this crazy stimulation?
There's a lot of gear in here. Artsy, weird, tiny, butterfly-based gear. And guys, I don't want it to sound like I live in a fairy garden. That's not what I'm saying. But
You and Tori Amos.
There are twinkly fairies everywhere and butterflies and stuff. There's a lot of bug specimens, actually, is more what's going on.
I feel strangely at peace with it, though. Yeah, okay, your place is beautiful. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Raindrops on roses.
I know, seriously.
That's where we're going.
It's funny you would say that, because I'm going to the Sound of Music sing-along tonight at the Hollywood Bowl.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
I can't wait. I'm so excited. No, seriously.
Start it off now.
Perfect.
That's amazing.
Perfect timing. I was like, what's that from again? Oh, the thing I'm seeing tonight at the Hollywood Bowl.
Are you dressing up? Is it a dress?
I'm not, thing? But there is a costume. Apparently there's
Element.
A costume parade. Yeah. I didn't know, because I've never been to this one. I'm trying to think. I may have gone to the Grease sing-along like years ago.
Oh,
but
fun.
This one happens every single year, and I know people are like very
I've
hardcore
heard of it.
About
yeah.
it. But I've never been. And my friend who invited me was telling me, like, okay, this is the time that the costume parade starts. Pass. This is the time that, like, the opening show starts. Pass. Like, there's only so much you can take. But I do enjoy that people take it that seriously. And I will say that I'm crushed, because I have to miss 80s night this year, because I'm going to be shooting. But I went last year, and I fully dressed up. I had a Weird Al Yankovic, when he used to take over MTV. I have an Al TV t-shirt, right? I have an Al TV, a vintage Al TV t-shirt that belonged to Weird Al, because he gave it to Chris, and then Chris gave it to me because it was too small for them. So I have a courtesy of Weird Al Yankovic t-shirt on. Crimped my hair.
I saw him in line the other night. I went to the IFC screening of Sleepwalk With Me, and he was in line just waiting to see the movie, and I totally crashed the line. I was like, I just want to see the movie.
I love Al.
Okay,
yeah.
So you wore
crimped
an
my
Al.
Hair, oh, crimped. Mini skirt. I might have been wearing double socks. Maybe I like pushed down and had like the two bunchy socks at the bottom. I think I rooted out a Swatch watch that I have that doesn't even have a battery.
Cool, that makes
and
me
I went
so happy.
So I did do it, and I think I thought more people would be dressed up, and then I got there, and it was like, you know, the Hollywood Bowl's big, and it was sold out. I'm gonna say maybe 5 to 10% of people were dressed up. So we were like, those of us who were dressed up were sort of looking at each other from a distance like, kudos, appreciate it. You're in my tribe. And everyone else was just shaking their heads like, I cannot believe you guys did this.
That's amazing.
But I've never danced so much in my life to the B-52s. They are the best. They might
love Shaq.
Hardcore. Oh my. I've never seen the whole entire Hollywood Bowl on their feet dancing.
It was amazing. And I don't even like, I love the B-52s, but not in a way where I listen to them. It's like if they come on the radio, you listen. Well, but I don't listen to their albums.
It's me. It's like when I think of the B-52s, I just remember when music television was in its inception. And I was dancing in my parents' living room. We lived on stilts too. So every like movement I made was like almost shook the house. But I just remember that video so vividly and memorizing every move and like, you know, swinging heads. And like, and I'm like, that's what people do. They get into a shack and they dance.
They shimmy, shimmy, shimmy. They still have, they've still got it. And live, they are sensational.
No way.
I was not, I was just like, oh, this will be a fun, campy thing to do with my evening. And instead, I ended up like, I couldn't stop dancing the B-52s and everyone felt the same way. And everyone was like, is this the best live band I've ever seen? And it's a band that you just like feel affection towards but don't care that much about until they're playing live. And then somehow you're like, this is the best show I've ever been to.
That's so fun.
It was cool. But this year, I don't think I'm going to be able to go. And it's and the Go-Go's are playing.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's bad. That's bad to miss.
What night is the 80s thing?
Next Saturday.
Oh, that's really fun. I'm not in town, but that's really fun.
Yeah. I try to do more stuff like that to sort of love LA in that way.
You know, that's, I feel like I'm having kind of that moment where I'm really falling in love with being here. I've been here, I started out in New York. I moved to New York when I was 17 and I was on a soap opera. That was my first job. So I was on All My Children for the first 3 years of my professional life, which was like such a, like a left turn for me because I was going to go to Carnegie Mellon and I started out in musical theater. I was a dancer and Ryan King, who was Bob Fosse's protege, was my mentor. And so I kind of thought that was the route I was going. I moved to New York, was on the soap opera and then meandered out to California because I come from a surfer family. My dad is a very famous
professional
surfer.
Yeah, where was the house on stilts?
The house on stilts. It was in a really small town called Gulf Breeze, Florida, on the Gulf Coast. It's basically Floribama.
Nice name for a town, Gulf Breeze.
It's beautiful. Like it's like the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen in my life. And now that I've been around the world and seen other beaches, I still hold true to that statement. Beautiful beaches. I was just there this weekend, but
again where it is. Gulf, I interrupted
it's
you.
Right. It's like right on the border between Alabama and Florida. Okay. They literally call it Floribama.
Floribama.
Yeah.
All
that's
right.
So that's where I'm from. And my family, we own surf shops along the Gulf Coast of Florida called Interlight Surf Shop. So I came out to California.
Was New York must have been such a huge change for you.
Oh
my gosh.
It was all my dreams came true. Like, and one, like I was a kid going to go to Carnegie Mellon and get my theater degree and do that and do the normal route. You know, when you want to be an artist, you're like, you go to a conservatory, you go to a school and you get lots and lots of training and they totally deconstruct you and then build you back up. And then you're released out into the world and you work and become famous.
Right.
That's the route. And
instead,
it was not become famous. Like I think from my small town, I'm like, everyone's famous, you know? And then my dream was to move to New York and, you know, be a working, not just a working, but I think be able to support myself as an artist. And like, boom, like this casting director, I was sitting in the audience of a talk show. It was Regis and Kathy Lee at the time. She talked to me on air. The casting director saw me, called the host, called Kathy Lee, said, I love that girl you were talking to in the audience. I would love to meet her. She ended up being from the South. I'm from the South. We connected. She was like, well, you should go to NYU because then you can be an extra on the show anytime you want. And I'm like, ooh. I was like, I don't think I can handle living in New York and being an extra.
Yeah.
But she remembered me. She remembered me a few months later and asked me to fly up for a screen test for the show. And that was when I was like, in the middle of my auditions for all the conservatories and I turned her down. I was like, Judy, I'm doing a one act festival. I'm playing Rizzo in Greece. I'm choreographing the school play. I've got all of my league auditions for all the schools. And I just don't really think I have time to audition for you. You know, I mean, I was so like, literally you could just see me like with a long cigarette, right. Just like, you know, like rolling calls or whatever. I turned her down. I was like, she's never, ever, ever going to reach out to me again. Like a few weeks later, she's like, I just can't get you out of my mind for this role on this show. Would you just put yourself on tape? I'll send you some sides. I was like, I don't know if I can do that. And she's like, why not? I don't know what sides are. But so the, you know, the whole
guys,
thing
those are the
out.
Pages of the script, the pages of the script.
The pages of the script. I just worked with, you know, plays.
Yeah, of course. I didn't know what sides were either. When I first came down here, someone was like, let me fax you the sides. And I was like, okay, back up.
Yeah. And now we're like, what's a fax machine? You know,
this is how life changes.
It does change quickly. And, you know, I was just didn't know anything about anything. And, put myself on tape. They ended up flying me up for a screen test. I found that I had gotten into Carnegie Mellon. So I was just like so stoked about that. And this was like a super bonus fun trip because I said I would come to the audition if they would fly my dad up with me and take us to a Broadway show. And so they did. He's a Civil War buff, and they had Civil War the musical on Broadway at the time. So that's what we went and
there
saw.
There was a musical called Civil War.
Yeah, it was. And actually Dave Clemens, who was the musical director, was my voice teacher when I was studying with Anne Ryan King. So it was just like all of the synergy was happening at the time of my life, like 3 days in New York, put up at the Empire Hotel in Lincoln Center. And I auditioned with like the men on the show. I had never seen people like this. Like, I didn't know that people existed. Like, literally, like chiseled from stone men that, like that just come out of the walls. Like, in The Mummy. Like, remember those, like, all those characters that, like, come out of the walls? Like, that's what it felt like. And I was 17, like, yeah. You know, just in high school. I was a big dreamer, that's for sure. And I loved just everything about art in general.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's go back a little bit further, because I love that idea. And, we've definitely had some musical theater. Mm-hmm. We've had musical theater friends on the podcast. We've had people who were like the, you know, high school, like angry nerds who hated musical theater people. Yeah. We've had a little bit of everything. And I realized along the way, I loved doing musical theater when I was younger, but I suddenly realized for the first time during this podcast a few months ago that we didn't do musicals in my high school.
Oh.
So I'm like, I guess we never did a single musical in high school. Like, that was over for me because high school, we just did plays.
Oh.
But okay. So the House on Stilts was in Gulf Breeze.
Yes.
And you have, tell me about your siblings again.
I have two brothers. I have a little brother, Sterling Spencer, who actually is an internet sensation. He's a super famous surfer. All of my family is like the surf culture. And that's how I ended up in California, was following the surf after my time in New York. But he has a blog called pinchmysalt.tv, and he's sponsored by Billabong and Verizon, and he made a feature length hilarious. It's basically like surf comedy in the vein of Napoleon Dynamite meets Flight of the Conchords, but it's surf stuff.
I gotta write this down.
And he made a movie called Surf Madness that like over a million people have watched, and he's just so funny. I mean, he really has an incredible following. And He's you know, basically what people are doing with Funny or Die, he's injecting that into the surf culture.
That's super cool.
Yeah, so he's not famous for contest surfing. He's famous for, I mean, he's an amazing surfer, but he makes these incredible movies. So that's my little brother, Sterling Spencer, and I have an older brother, Yancey Spencer, who is also an incredible surfer and lives in my hometown.
When we talk about these sort of family legacies of stuff like that, is there ever a time when, you know, kids with their parents sort of go, yeah, you guys do this. Like, yeah, I get it. You own surf shops. Maybe I'm not going to be that person. Or is it just so ingrained in the sort of DNA of your family that that never even came into play? Was it just like, yep, we surf. Like, that's what we do. Because I love this. That's something beautifully, spiritually simplistic about that.
Yeah, but, you know, I didn't know that other people didn't have this, like, incredible existence. You know, I saw my dad every day. My mother is an artist and a folk singer and a voice teacher, and she plays like seven different instruments. And, you know, I come from this really, really very spiritual and very connected family. And, what happened was I started surfing when I was 3 years old. You know, I mean, I see it with my son. You know, I have a 4-year-old, and, you know, the things that I'm interested in and things I'm doing, you naturally just kind of go along for the ride and see if it's something that they're interested in as well, if they have an adeptness to it. And so I started surfing when I was 3, and my dad was stoked. He was like, yes, this is happening. I have a surfer daughter. This is amazing. And then my mother, who like maybe went to the beach twice in her life, she was like, I really don't want her to get skin cancer. Can she do anything else? So my dad put me in dance class because he felt like it was kind of like land surfing. And once I found that, it was like, that was it. And my dad loved the arts. So I think he felt like, okay, you know, she doesn't have to be a server, and she has, she's so interested in dance and singing. I mean, it was just really natural. It was natural in the home. And
was it like ballet at first?
Yeah, it was like tap, ballet, jazz, like whatever. I mean, I just wanted to move. Really, it was solid gold.
Until, nice.
Like my parents would, like at three, would catch me like finding solid gold and like literally like trying to like, you know, drop my pelvis to the floor. My mother's like, Satan be gone. You know, like she was like, so concerned. She was like, oh my gosh, my daughter's a heathen. And you know, I'm from this really small town on the Gulf Coast. And also too, you know, my dad traveled the world surfing, but he always came back home. He has this real sense of community and then built the surf shops there. And you know, surfing is, it's like being a professional athlete in any other capacity. It's just, it's just kind of, more off the beaten path. People just don't know what it's like. It's very counterculture. You know, it's counterculture. And so I didn't realize I was being raised counterculture my whole life. And then now I'm like the black sheep of the family because I pursued, you know, art and all of, I guess, the entertainment aspect of it. But now my little brother is coming back around and I'm not the black sheep at all. I didn't realize it was art all along, you know, the way my dad viewed surfing and the way that he viewed his life as a surfer was really like an artist. You know, it's such a soul thing to be a surfer, to really devote your life to the surfer's way. It comes from your soul. And I feel the same way when about art and, you know, in any capacity, like from Burning Love, like to everything, you know, everything is just like has this. And I feel like the people, I don't know if you feel this way, but the people that I've been able to align myself with are really like just really deep individuals and are able to channel that in a lot
and
of
you could so
tones.
Easily not, we've talked about this on the podcast before, but you could so easily not have that in LA.
Yeah.
You can you have your pick of the most superficial, most plastic, most kind of poisonous relationships to have with friends or colleagues or whatever in Los Angeles. And then you also have your choice all the way down the line to like some of the most profoundly brilliant, brilliant, beautiful, searching.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think
sensitive people.
That's maybe like kind of how we got in this whole rant. I think it was like refalling in love with LA, that there's so much available to us. And I feel
good
like that's
callback,
a part of it.
So far from that, I could not have told you that's
no,
where we started.
I think that's why I'm refalling in love with all the opportunities. There is this fantastic feeling of seeking. You know, my dad always talked about surfing was that, you know, being a professional seeker, you know, that you're always in the water and in the waves and you're always seeking nature. You're always seeking and being connected to something bigger than yourself. And we are very fortunate that there is such a counterculture within LA that
Absolutely.
Really is developing that. I mean, I almost don't even see the plastic side of how people associate LA. I don't even know it. And maybe that's why I'm falling deeper in love with it. And I don't spend a lot of time here, actually. Like, I'm here maybe half the time because everything that's shooting right now is not in LA. But yeah. I'm really enjoying this being my base, you know. And also, like, I even wrote a thing, because I know that you are the host on the Huffington Post live series. But they asked me to do a piece of, like, when did you know that Los Angeles was going to be your home? And it was so funny. I think it was this thing where I realized I just couldn't leave because my home was the people. You know, I've just found the most incredible group of people here. And wherever I go, I see them in LA. You know, people are very transient in LA too. So,
and understanding of like, in, I think that's one of the things that's so lovely. And maybe this happens everywhere as we grow older and everybody has lives and kids and, you know, things that tie them to those responsibilities. But I feel like there's such an understanding in Los Angeles. The flip side of that is that like we can all flake on each other
totally.
And everyone's fine. And so then you don't see people for that reason. Yeah. But you, that you
it's
know, those,
nomadic
everybody
society.
Understands and that it's nomadic and that you can have a fiercely passionate friendship with someone and not ever see them, but know that that foundation is so strong and that there's an understanding about kind of what this life is like, that you sort of carry those people with you
Absolutely.
In a way that, you know, feels very fortunate.
And we are, you know, the luxury, I know this is kind of the constant dichotomy about communication in our present culture is that we have so much access to communicating, and yet it's all through texting and it's all through like sending pictures and it's all through media. And, you know, are we actually communicating? Are we actually connecting? But I've become so grateful. I mean, my relation, like you said, you can have like these intense in-person encounters with people and then you go away for a while. But my gosh, like my iPhone has become so precious to me because I'm like, that's how I keep the connectivity alive. And I'm really grateful for all of that. And I think it is possible to have immensely deep relationships in our town. You know, I definitely feel it. And it seems like you've the same
thing. I definitely do. It's like soul food. It absolutely is. Like, it feeds you, man. It feeds you.
Come on, Tyler Perry. Let's make a movie.
Maybe we've been shooting too much in Georgia between the two of us.
I just got back from Georgia. I was there for 3 months shooting.
I do like it down there. That's where Dinner and a Movie shot, too. So I did that for like, 7 years now. I can't remember how long I was on that show.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay,
so was your mom's music something that like played a key in your love of music, or was it just totally separate?
Well, my mom was singing every day while I was in the womb, and
that totally fits with everything you've told me so far about your family.
And she has one of the most beautiful voices I've ever heard. I mean, if she didn't have terrifyingly wonderful stage fright. She probably would have been one of the most famous singers ever. She's in the vein of like, you know, Judy Collins and Joni Mitchell. And so I heard a lot of that growing up, you know, a lot of beautiful folk songs. And she plays 7 different instruments, and she has her major in the string bass.
Oh, wow.
Like, it's hilarious. It's this, you know, 5'6", like 110-pound woman with like hair beyond her bottom playing the stand-up string bass.
I wish I had footage to look at.
And a unibrow. There was like a total unibrow. Like, it was unibrow, braces, like, and I was like her reincarnated in high school. Like, we were really cool, is what I'm trying to say. We were super cool.
Definitely not nerds.
Yeah, totes not nerds.
7 instruments.
Yeah, she's kind of brilliant. And
does she still play just for the joy?
Yeah, actually, I was just in Florida this past weekend, and she was serenading me with, because she sang me bits and pieces of Suzanne by Leonard Cohen, which is actually the song that inspired my character on Mad Men. And my mother sang that to me my whole life, and I had no idea that my character was based on that song. And then halfway through Mad Men, Matt Weiner sat me down, and he was like, you know, have I shared with you the inspiration behind your character? And I was like, I felt like he was going to say something that was going to like be so familiar. Cause I remember getting the pseudo sides that they send you for the audition, you know, where they mask all the names and make it seem like you're not actually going in for that character,
right?
But you totally are. Uh-oh. And, I knew even just from those sides, I knew that I knew this woman. I just knew her. And then when he told me that was based on that song, I just burst into tears. He's such an intuitive, magical writer, and
yeah,
just the fact that that, you know, was congruent in my life and in what Matt had seen for the character was just really moving. So I grew up with a lot of that, and then my mother was totes old schools. Just gonna make everything plural. With movies, so I really only saw classic movies like Summer Stock, Judy Garland, Summer Stock. I'll never forget when she bopped up on that farm stage in her tuxedo jacket and started singing "Forget Your Troubles, Come On, Get Happy," you know, and like my mom and I are like dancing and singing, you know, along with Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand, Funny Girl. I mean, I just didn't know that it was possible to see a woman be so glamorous and so beautiful and so funny and so geeky and so talented, you know? So my mother was a huge influence in introducing me to a lot of my musical influences.
Those Barbara Streisand movies. What a badass.
Oh my gosh. She's just so
incredible. It took me a long time. See, I did not see any Barbara Streisand movies until I was probably in my very early 20s. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't get it. I mean, yeah. I sort of got it, but it was one of those things where I think I just knew her older. So mm-hmm. I thought of like her with the nails and like the sort of,
that was a running theme,
you know, all of that. And I just had not seen, I think I made the conscious decision not to like her without having ever seen her younger. I was like, I won't like her.
Yeah.
And then I finally saw probably Funny Girl or, what's that one with Ryan O'Neal?
The Way We Were.
No,
or that's Robert Redford. On a Clear Day.
I can't. This one was like a screwball comedy where it involves like a suitcase that they all have matching suitcases. I think Buck Henry wrote it. Anyway,
gosh, I haven't
seen
that.
It's like a total screwball wackadoo comedy. It's really cheeky and silly, but it's so funny, and so her timing is so amazing.
Oh my gosh,
and
her timing is so
amazing. She's so flirtatious
amazing.
With him in the that just clever like back and forth repartee kind of way. And I definitely was like, oh my gosh, I've been completely missing out on this. Like, I can't believe I made a decision about her that was so wrong from that I missed all this time that I could have been loving her.
Oh, that's okay.
You know what? It's all right.
I started probably too early. I was like 5 or 6 years old when I started watching her, and it was like, you know, you just kind of lose your mind when you see someone like that. She was so influential. Liza Minnelli, I mean, all of those gals were what I watched. So that was, you know, going back to my mother, just in her influence, she was just a, you know, even still, she just seems like a total throwback. I mean, you see her, she made all of my clothes growing up too, and she still makes a lot of her own clothes, and she just is that shape, you know, that like classic kind of Mad Men-esque shape in her hair. She looks like Jackie O, Stargirl, and she's a total like screwball. Like, she's super quirky. Like, all my friends are like, your mom is a character. And I know. She's dresses like a, you know, character out of Mad Men, but she acts like Barbra Streisand, and
God,
she's funny.
It.
She's really
and
funny.
And your parents are still together? Did I ask you that? I can't remember.
My father passed away very suddenly last year on Valentine's Day. But they were together 34 years. And, so it's been about a year and a half since his passing. And yeah, they were like such an incredible love story for me to see.
I'm so sorry. How is she doing? I mean, obviously, how are you doing? Yeah. How is she doing?
Well, you know, terrible. I mean, you know, there's an element of we're terrible, you know, because it's such a devastating sudden loss, you know. But then there's this whole grace that comes with it. You know, my father actually died surfing at County Line when he was out here visiting me on Valentine's Day last year. And he came out because I was going through a particularly hard time, and to be with my 4-year-old son. And he started having a heart attack while he was surfing at one of his favorite surf spots on one of the most beautiful days. I remember him calling me. My dad would call me to tell me the surf report wherever he was. And he kept journals of every single day of what the surf was, even if it was flat or whatever. He kept a journal of every single day for, I mean, at least, I would say 25 years of journals of just how the surf was every day. And he gave the surf report every morning on the Gulf Coast. And so on his way driving out there from my house to Malibu, he called me. He was like, hey, you know, we should get dinner tonight. It's Valentine's Day. You're my Valentine today. It'd been 10 years since we'd actually been in the same space on Valentine's Day. And then he said that it was the most knocked down, beautiful day. And probably the best he had seen the surf at County Line in many years, and couldn't wait to get in the water. And then he called me about an hour and a half later, which is pretty soon, you know, when you have the whole afternoon to surf. And he had started having a heart attack in the water, and he'd made it up. You kind of have to walk up a cliff to where he had my car, and he grabbed his phone and he called me and said, Abby, I'm having a heart attack. And, you know, obviously I fell to my knees in disbelief. I need you to call 911. I love you, and pray. And then he hung up the phone, and about 10 minutes later, he was gone. So it's been quite a year, you know, and kind of the, you know, pretty poetic passing, looking out at the waves that changed his life. He found surfing when he was 15, and until he changed his life. And he also was holding my mother's Valentine's Day card that she had sent him when the fire chief made it to him before he had slipped away, and he was holding it, and he wasn't in any pain. He said, he just said that by the time the ambulance got there, as soon as they pulled the gurney out, he just was gone. It was like, you know, he just said it was a really sudden and peaceful passing. And so, yeah, it's been a year. So my mother's very strong. You know, my little brother just got married, and I was just there for the wedding, and we put my father's headstone on his grave. And it was like having my mom and my brothers, I have an older brother too. You know, being there, cause my little brother's 5 years younger, my older brother's 7 years older. So we didn't really like grow up buddy, buddy. Like, we weren't friends. But it's so funny to go back, and like, they're just crazy people, like in the best way. So fun, like an incredible spirit. So when I say that it was a graceful passing, you know, I think we feel a lot of grace because his life was so wonderful. You know, 7,000 people came to his funeral. And
oh my God.
It was a big surf paddle out. And it's kind of crazy too, because I did this movie called Chasing Mavericks, which is about this kid named Jay Moriarty, who also had a very early, you know, before his time death, true story, Curtis Hanson directed. And when they cast me in the movie, because Jennifer Connelly and Robin Wright Penn couldn't do it. Thank you, ladies.
You are not the same age as either of them. Okay.
No, I know. I'm not. But, you know, I'd be their backup dancer any day, you know.
Sure. All due respect to them. I just wanted to make an observation for anybody
that's
who
so interesting.
Would be doing the math in their head going, wait a minute.
I didn't put that together.
Yeah.
But thank you. Mm-hmm. I got this movie and they had no idea who my dad was. So when I got cast and showed up on set for the makeup and hair test, I got to tell them my story about my father and how I came to the movie. And we just were all sobbing, like, you know, because Jay's story is really moving. And he started a whole movement called Live Like Jay about doing things that feel beyond your reach. You know, this kid, fatherless kid who gets taken in by a surf coach named Frosty Hessen, who rides these secret huge waves and ends up changing like a whole community's, not only this boy's life, but a whole community. Just to see someone have a dream.
Did I see the trailer for this?
Probably, yeah.
I did, in the theater I saw, and I got excited, and I think I shouted your name out, and people were like,
shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so crazy, like, you know, they have this tradition of a paddle out in the surf world, and it's a really beautiful spiritual tradition where everyone shows up at the beach with their boards, and you go out in the water, and everyone has flowers, and you release all of these flowers, and we did it on a cross, you know, into the water. And there were 1,000 people in the water and then like 6,000 people on the beach that showed up for this paddle out. And the day before, 2,000 people came to my father's funeral. And it's just crazy because he was such a quiet person, you know, he was super shy. And he was definitely just someone who lived what he said and said what he lived. And he didn't do it in a loud way, but he lived, you know, he lived in a space where acts of kindness were what spoke for him. And man, it's like when you see that, like, because he was not outgoing. Oh my gosh, like that your life really can touch people without you having to say very much. That it really is about the way you live, not how you say you live. You know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been such a weird time. Gosh. You know, it's been a lot of personal tragedy, and then in work, it's been a lot of triumph. You know, I'm just so grateful to be an artist. And I think, you know, what we were talking about earlier, like, I've been really grateful for the Los Angeles community. You know, I've received incredible acts of kindness from people that I've worked with here and my community here in ways that I didn't know were possible of the human spirit. So I think that's maybe made me a bit more entrenched in, you know, feeling like Los Angeles ever engulfs me into saying I'm home.
Yeah.
It's definitely home base.
It sneaks up on you. Yeah. I think at least it did for me.
Yeah. It totally did. The first 2 years were terrible. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like, I always tell you, I'm like, just give it 2 years. But it takes a lot of work. You know, you have to put yourself in harm's way. And I think you also have to put yourself in environments where you might find like-minded people.
Yeah.
That you'd like to be around.
Well, I know we talked about that because I do. And I don't know. I guess I don't know that I said it in these words, but I've said it on the podcast before, which is that I feel like Los Angeles has the ability to turn you into the best version of yourself or the worst.
Yeah.
You can either become incredibly superficial and believe everything that you're told or not told.
Or everything that you think about yourself, or people tell you about yourself.
Every bad thing that you think about yourself. Very or every inflated. Good thing that you think, you know. Yeah. And just, and just like the artifice of that, both on both sides, like the sort of narcissism on both sides. Like, people think that, you know, if you're narcissistic, that it just means that you think you're amazing, but it doesn't. It also means you think everything's your fault. So you're just so self-obsessed that you think everything's about you. So if somebody's shitty to you, you're like, what did I do?
Yeah.
But if someone's like happy, then you're like, nah, I'm pretty great.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, this industry can't, I shouldn't say city, that's not fair to people who live here who don't do what we do, but the industry
there, I'm
has
sorry,
the
wait,
potential.
There are people who live here that don't do what
one
we
or
do.
Two.
One I'm going to have to go talk to Mrs. Stern next door.
Don't go to a coffee shop to prove years. Me. Right. Yeah, don't go. You will only see laptops and I will be proven wrong. But
okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
Hey, if you like your podcast to be focused and well-researched and your podcast host to be uncharismatic, unhorny strangers who have no interest in horses, then this is not the podcast for you.
Again, what's your deal? I'm Emily.
I'm Lisa.
Our show's called Baby Geniuses.
And its hosts are horny adult idiots. We discover weird Wikipedia pages every episode.
We discuss institutional misogyny.
We ask each other the dumbest questions, and our listeners won't stop sending us pictures of their butts.
We haven't asked them to stop, but they also aren't stopping.
Join us on Baby Geniuses.
Every other week on MaximumFun.org.
Did you gravitate towards Venice because of the kind of surf culture and stuff? Did you ever live over there?
Yeah, well, I actually, it was between the establishment that we're sitting in right now,
which will
that's right, guys. Side note, now that we've just outed ourselves, we had to split this into two
because
Abby and I got on such a tangent when we were recording the other day that we both ran out of time to leave. So this is actually the part,
round two.
The second part we picked back up,
and it's later at night, so if we sound really,
if there's
really
like
low,
there's, and if there's crickets in the background, also know that it's not like I don't have a cricket farm.
Yeah, I did. It was between this place and a place in Venice that I was looking at, and I thought this place was just a little bit more central and seemed a little bit better fit. And also, a friend of mine swooped in and got it before day. Oh. It was like literally between me and a friend, and he kind of got there first, so I deferred to him. But it was really funny. I deferred to him, but I was the reason he got it, because he never would have had any fire under him to go after that place if I wasn't like looming. I was like, I'm going to get that place. If you get it. I'm deferring to your first right of refusal, but I'm going to get that place. So he got it, and then I live here. So it's kind of funny.
It's so funny. It's like when they say that, you know, if you're in retail, they used to say that if somebody touches like picks up something that hasn't been picked up in a really long time and puts it down, even if they don't buy it, it's gonna sell like a couple
really?
Of days later.
No way.
Because there's just like people, there
magic.
Was this sort of
magic.
It is like a, I mean, that seems ridiculous to put onto something like retail sales, but I always worked for like, I was super into home furnishings and stuff, and that was sort of what I thought I was gonna do.
Oh, everybody, really?
These guys all know this, but so it was always like very kind of ABC Carpet and Home, sort of like touchy feely.
Well, I can see it by your place. I mean, your place is beautiful.
So is this one. But
it was all flea market
stuff. But they would talk about like energy, like the energy, especially, in fact, flea market stuff is a great example. The energy of stuff where there's just one of it, and the energy that, like, if somebody pays attention to something and like loves it, a lot of people believe. Even in like something you would think as being such a sterile, like, ew, retail sales, people are like, that has an energy to it. And somebody else will feel that and pick up on it. And then it sells like the same day. If it's like a vase or an old table or whatever.
Wow, that's so interesting.
I've
never thought about that, but that makes so much sense. And I spend a lot of time. My friends have this place around the corner called Teeny, on Fairfax and...
This is not IKEA, right?
This is not IKEA.
Yeah, and I've definitely gotten a bunch of stuff from there before they had a storefront, when they were just a website, and you would just like go meet them, and they would roll up a garage and
Alex
say, this is what you saw online.
Is a friend of mine, and he got me really thinking about this, because I'm definitely, you know, I'm a fan of the nostalgia movement. It's what I call it, like the hipstamatic, and even Instagram, you know, there's something about, and I think after my father's passing, there is something of me that longs for a simpler, longs for that, you know, that thing. Like, I have these pictures of him, you know, when I was little, from the 70s, or, you know, from the late 70s, early 80s, and, or even just him with my older brother. And there's just something about the film over it that just seems like it'll last forever. So I feel that way about everything now.
Yeah.
and so everything in here is like, I mean, nothing costs like, not, I mean, it's all cost nothing, but it's just, it's like, oh, I found that, you know, I found that, or like this light over here, like that was like $300 at the Fairfax flea market.
Yeah.
We're looking at this industrial light that literally looks like restoration hardware, you know, mummified it and like expensified it and turned it into some like art piece. And I got for like $300 at that. And I just, I'm so proud of that.
No, like, absolutely.
It's such a win.
I love that. I love stuff with a history. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to Surfing Cowboys on Abbot Kinney?
Yeah, I have.
That seems like, I mean, now listen, I don't mean to like attach every surfing thing ever to you because of that, but I have that's like a perfect example of that.
I saw someone wearing a shirt that said Surfing Cowboys today. That's
I think
so funny
they do. They
that.
Have this whole sort of, I'm looking for my bottle of water, guys. I'm rustling through my bag
now. It's like your stun gun.
It's not even that important. I'm not like dying of thirst, but I just thought if I could find it, and
you
I just did
my water. Right there. Oh, there it is. Okay, you're still like me. Why do girls? Why do we put bottles of water where it could unattach itself from its cap and spill everywhere and get all over our stuff with our computers and our iPads and our iPhones and all of our makeup and all of our lives?
Let me go
in our bag
and say I also have a salad that I got from Whole Foods on my way here that's also sitting next to everything.
This is identical
that's like
to my life. I know, but I do that too. Mm-hmm. Why do we do that?
And I'm going to go a step even further and say I will always set a glass or a bottle right next to my computer keyboard. With the full knowledge that I am extremely clumsy. I can't tell you how many times I've knocked water onto my keys. So many times. I think I've ruined like 3 computers by doing that.
My God,
and I've never learned. I just knocked it over.
I don't know what it is, but I find great comfort in this, what just happened.
Yeah.
I find great comfort.
Not
I'm like,
to worry.
I'm like, oh, she's got a salad, a yoga mat,
listen,
a bottle of water.
I might as well have like an open bottle of cold cream in there. Like, I just forgot to put the cap on. Yeah. What's the worst that could happen?
I'm trying to think what the grossest thing is that I've spilled in my purse. Like, I'm just like,
that's a good question too. I feel like, boy, all it takes is like one day of me grabbing a handful of trail mix for some reason, or like putting it in a bag. It doesn't matter. Somehow I'll end up with sunflower seed bits for months
in my car seat too. Months. Like all over my car, in my jeans, in my hair.
But there's got to be something, because you have a little boy, and there's got to be something kind of like, someone used this expression that I had forgotten about from Winnie the Pooh about a year ago. They were like, hey, you know what, it's fun, because they said, oh, I just got this shirt, now I have mustard on it. I'm always getting mustard all over everything, so I ate a lot of mustard. I can't explain why. I don't really know, but I do enjoy mustard. And it's and I'm also a klutz, so it's a bad combination. Okay. I wish I liked just white vinegar and seltzer water. But
I like mustard too.
I'm always like, oh, I just got mustard on this. And someone was like, and I just got this. And someone was like, yeah, you just gave Tigger the keys. Which is, I guess, because the idea is that you, when you have something brand new, if you're too anal retentive about keeping it perfect, then you won't even really enjoy it because you'd be so anal about it. But if you give Tigger the keys and Tigger messes, like crashes your car, gets a scratch on something or whatever, then the damage is done. Then it's like, look, from this get-go, I knew that it wasn't going to stay perfect. And then I could just enjoy it and kind of be comfortable in my skin and my own space with it or whatever. And so I think that I, going back to the idea of having a kid, I guess I would hope too that if we are the kind of people who are sort of a mess, that it's maybe better when you have a kid, because you're not that person going in that's like, don't touch that, don't do that, don't mess that up, don't da da da. Like, can there be a more relaxed feeling about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think growing up on the beach and growing up with brothers, you know, I definitely, you know. And my, you know, my, again, my parents, it's like, you know, we were taught to take care of things, but to hold things very loosely, you know, that, and I think, you know, again, I really feel it, you know, I think I knew it in my head, but experiencing loss and you just,
oh my God. Oh yeah. Okay. Sorry. All of a sudden I thought that, my thing had stopped.
Yeah. That we had poured water all over your computer.
Pretty much.
You know, that you can't take any of it with you.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I think that is having, it's such an incredible gift every day to, because you want to teach values, you know, you want him to learn how to value things and take care of things and take care of his toys and, you know, have consequences when things are not being taken care of because they break.
Yeah.
So there's that fine line between, you know, being a responsible human being and being respectful, like being not only respectful to humans, but respectful to our things, like that instilling respect.
I agree.
You
because
know?
I cherish things. Yeah. I mean, I think we both have that relationship, even to like what we just described about the energy of what we have in our home and stuff. It's there's a nice, ultimately, hopefully, a nice balance you strike where you cherish and respect, but it's
but
not
you
the
hold
end of
it
the
very
world
loosely.
Exactly.
And you know, I mean, I definitely, I don't know things. I think I've become. I'm much more of a collector of people than things. You know, I wanna get to the point. I don't think I'm there yet, but I think the journey I hope to be on is to just be very malleable and mobile, and that making sure that my priorities are on people's hearts. You know, like that definitely, like even tonight, actually, you know, my son, I was putting him down to sleep and he was really tired and he's kind of, you know, getting a little bad attitude and saying some things that were not very nice to his mommy.
Like, what'd he say? You don't have to say if you don't want to.
You know, what was some of the zingers that he said?
Oh, zingers.
I mean, he's four.
He zinged you.
Yeah. Oh, it was really funny. He was like, "Mommy, I'm tired. Just let me be." You know? And then he like flopped open his legs. And I, of course, I burst out laughing, you know, but that gentle place of, you know, letting him develop his personality and, you know, but then not spill milk on the coffee table because, you know, we want to keep the coffee table for a while, but not it being a big deal. Like it's such a, I don't know.
It is.
I just feel like I'm on the journey with it myself, you know, to hold things very loosely. I had a really good lesson in that. I had been eyeing this Michael Kors belt for, you know what I mean? Where you get something in your life and you're like, that's supposed to be in my life,
yeah.
But it's expensive. And then you're like, I don't know if I want to spend the money on it, but you kind of keep an eye on it. And then it keeps coming and you're like, I don't know you guys, like maybe this belt's supposed to be in my life. Like maybe this belt's supposed to be in my life. And so I saw the belt, like it was like this really cool leather, like kimono belt. I was like, oh my gosh, like this is the thing. Like this is the thing, you guys. And it was on sale for like $100 at, you know, Michael Kors store. And like, oh my gosh. And I got it. I mean, it's a really, like this really crazy expensive belt because it was like an art piece. I felt it was an art piece. And so I got it and it accidentally got thrown away. Like it was in a box and like as things were being cleaned out, it accidentally got thrown away.
Been there.
It, right?
Yeah.
And
I got one. I'm going to tell you right after
this. Okay, good. So I remember just having this urge to be like, to freak out, you know, I remember like very clearly, like it was like time started to slow and freak out because it was like money and time and expenditure. And then, and I literally just in the same breath was like, belt was too important to me. Yeah. Belt was too important right? to me. Like, you know, and the hope that what I really hoped was that in its recyclable afterlife that it had entered,
yeah.
that someone found it and was enjoying the belt,
yes.
you know what I mean? But I feel like that's a constant journey of life is like, I got mustard on, you know, like just that balance of, I love it. Mustard yeah. on the shirt, you know what yeah. I mean? Something brand new mustard on the shirt. And it just keeps things in perspective.
Yeah. Here's mine real quick okay. because this was a rough one. And it wasn't even a rough one in the sense that it was about the expense of something, but in terms of like you'll
value
you'll get it.
Okay.
So there's this place in Manhattan that I love to go when I'm there. It's like a vintage jewelry store.
Oh, cool.
And it's not an expensive vintage jewelry store. It's not like in the Lower East Side where like they just hike everything up. They
Jeez,
like
Louisa.
You know, scrounge at yard sales and then yeah. suddenly something's
vintage shopping is my hobby when I'm on location. So
Ditto,
I totally
yes,
say, yeah.
100% yes. Mm-hmm. And so, but this place is really great because it does have some like really collectible, beautiful pieces. If people want to come in and get vintage engagement rings and stuff like that, they can. But they also just have like great, you know, drawers that you can just rummage through and, you know, little like Bakelite bracelets that aren't that expensive mm-hmm. and little scarves and stuff. They just have a really nice assortment and you can go in there and like buy a brooch for $5 or you can go in there and spend, it's called Pippin.
Pippin?
Pippin Jewelry. And I'll send you the link. It's
Eagles
in Chelsea.
Eagles belong where they can ramble. I just love that musical so much.
Listen, it might be named after that for all I know. So I was there and they had like, they have like, you know, like old printer's drawers where they're thin drawers. And then the little tags on them that say like, you know, circle brooches, mm-hmm. Tie pins. Mm-hmm. And they had one that was just like a mishmash of stuff. It was just like random. And I opened it up and I was like, yeah, just like kind of futzing around. And there's like this vintage ID bracelet, like this brass vintage ID bracelet that's really old, but it's totally intact. And it has my initials, JV.
No way.
And I was like, and it was only like $5. Aww. And it was adorable. And I was like, oh my God, what are the chances?
So sweet.
There's no other ID bracelets. There's nothing even remotely resembling this. It's just sitting there. And so I bought it and I was so excited. And it just felt like it was one of those things where you feel like the universe is showing you that there's a purpose, you know, and I don't necessarily even believe that all the time, but like the next person, I do enjoy those moments where you feel like everything is as it should be.
Yeah.
I was meant to, you know,
everything was working towards this moment.
Yeah. And I bought it and I put it on.
And you felt so good.
And by the end of the day, gone.
No.
I mean, I had it.
How?
I just fell off.
It just fell
off. On the streets of Manhattan.
No way.
I got to enjoy it for like less than 6 hours.
Was it a clasp situation?
It was a clasp.
Did you cry?
I was so, I kind of had the crying feeling, but I was so perplexed. I think the immediate thing that I felt, even before I was like, wanted to cry, was, I don't get it. I don't get it. Why did I find this and get it and buy it and get it and only get to have it for 6 hours?
Yeah, why only six hours of joy?
What's that supposed to teach me? But I guess I sort of did go, well, it was really exciting to find it. Maybe it was more exciting in that moment to find it and to know and to feel that moment of connectedness than it was for me to hold on to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I it's so funny. I was thinking about this the other day too. I was in the Whole Foods parking lot and, this woman had dropped a penny and I was like, oh, you know, kind of behind her, like, oh, you dropped your penny, you know, would you like it? And she looked and she was like, no, for someone who really wants, you know, for someone else. Like, and it made me think like, oh, that's such a cool little practice of like dropping a penny or leaving it for someone else. Cause you know that, and it was heads up too. And like literally within 2 seconds, someone came by and swooped it up and it like made their day, like a heads up penny. And
Good luck. I know.
Yeah. It's just so funny.
I like little pay. I mean, that literally is like the most tiny version of pay it forward, but I really do like, and I wish that would have been a better movie. But I really do I like that feeling. I like making those small decisions when, and listen, I don't want this to turn into like, we just patting ourselves on the back of how awesome we are. But I do love like those moments where, for whatever reason, either it's because you're in a bad mood and you somehow see yourself through with a kind act, or you're in a great mood, which is, it's really easy to be generous, right? Yeah. It's like giving at the holidays. But if either one of those, just that moment where you're like, I know I'm only going to be at this meter for 15 minutes. I'm using my credit card. I'm going to go ahead and get the whole 2 hours.
Yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and let somebody enjoy the 1 hour and 45 minutes on me.
Totally.
Those are nice.
I think that's, you know, I mentioned it earlier, that's on lots of different scales. That's how my father lived his life. And I didn't even know the capacity of it until after he was gone. And I definitely hope that I get to be a giver. Like, I mean, he's just a giver and big giver. And I'd love to be a big giver, you know.
Were you so stunned when you saw, when all those people were there?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I think I was most stunned how everyone felt such a personal connection to him. And because he was always my father, you know.
Sure.
And I knew he was a famous surfer and I'd been to all the surf contests and I'd seen all the magazines, you know, and I'd seen the trophies and all the ads. And but the surfing world is definitely, you know, secular. It's and it's also counterculture, too. So it's not, you know, it's not the thing that is most in our, you know,
you're like, if you're in that world, obviously you're seeing it as you're seeing it, but you were also seeing the rest of the world and that like that it didn't necessarily have
It's
not like he was a Kennedy
I just didn't realize how much the community, how much he had affected the community.
Yeah.
I mean, having the businesses there and just the way that he lived his life. I mean, I felt it directly. I mean, I felt it the most. Like I was the receiver of most of the kind. So I knew how I felt. I just didn't know the ripple effects of his life. And yeah, it's just really moving. You know, you definitely feel a great responsibility, especially being his daughter. And, you know, he's my best friend too. So just kind of wanting to keep the legacy going.
Yeah.
You know, I think we as a family feel that responsibility. And
does your mom feel looked after by the community above and beyond?
Kind of? Everyone's been really, I mean, my mom's super strong. I mean, like she is like,
I certainly don't mean to say like, I would say that too, if your mom had been
absolutely,
person, you know,
you know, I mean, there's that fine line with her, you know, sometimes I feel like she's so independent and so strong and so, that, you know, I wonder, is she having the right balance? But then I see she's really open with people too about how she's doing. And no, I mean, neighbor, everybody is holding her, you know, in some capacity. And it's beautiful, you know, it's really beautiful to see.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
Hi, it's me, April Wolf, the host of Switchblade Sisters and co-writer of the new horror film, Black Christmas.
And I'm Katie Walsh, film critic and occasional host of Switchblade Sisters.
We're here to announce that for one episode, we will be doing something a little different. Much like Jeff Goldblum and David Cronenberg's The Fly, I will be going through a truly disturbing transformation.
April will transform from the interviewer into the interviewee. I will be asking her all about her new film, Black Christmas, her writing process, and ongoing existential dread.
But I will also be discussing John Carpenter's perfect masterpiece, Prince of Darkness.
You guys seen any movies you like?
So tune in to Switchblade Sisters for a one-of-a-kind episode with April Wolf and me, Katie Walsh.
See you then.
Only the corrupt I listen to now.
God, we didn't really talk that much about your adolescence, but we kind of did.
Oh, yeah.
That's how this podcast works. Is it always ends up sort of being...
You want to talk about my bongo, the bongo years, I like to call them. Remember bongo? Guess and bongo were like the two big brands when I was in middle school.
Yeah.
Fifth grade to middle school.
I was actually thinking about
that today because I was looking at the spring fashion shows. I think it was, maybe it was Calvin Klein. I don't know. It was literally just a progression of color of like, you know, color from head to toe. And it was like a few different brands that kind of, you know, or designers had been pursuing this like, you know, not just a pop of color. It was a whole outfit of color. And that's what bongo was like royal blue jean shorts, royal blue button-up shirts, royal blue t-shirts.
Benetton was kind of like that, too.
Yeah, totally.
Like they just went for it. Like, here's a bright canary yellow head-to-toe look.
Yeah, totally. And that's, it's kind of coming back this spring. So I'm very curious to see. Because that when I see that, I'm like, bongo. Like, that's all, like, in the item magenta. I had a red and I had a royal blue. And I wore white kids. And I was very envious of all the girls who had a more multicolored wardrobe because they were more popular. And I was just trying to fit in and make sure that my shorts were just above my fingertips. So, like, I had to raise my shoulders because we had that rule that you had to... like your shorts had to be longer than your fingertips in school.
I wonder if we had that. I was so self-conscious about my body that I would never have even potentially violated any dress
code. When did you become self-conscious about your body?
As long as I can remember.
Really?
You'll see pictures. There's pictures of me like in grade school and junior high where you will see that like every other girl is in a bathing suit and I have like a t-shirt and shorts on.
Interesting.
I just never felt comfortable.
Huh. How do you feel? Like, what was your progression? Like, do you know what ignited that or what triggered that? And how has that been?
Because
I mean, I'm a woman too. And I remember the moment where I started to become self-conscious and started to doubt my body.
It's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, certainly there are definitely pictures of me as a little kid where like, I clearly don't care and don't have any idea. I do feel like it started really early for me. I just feel like it's a really good question and I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I remember like bathing suits in the 80s and being like, that won't look good on me. I don't have, and somewhere along the line, and I think this is very, I guess I've never articulated it like this before, but
I think it's actually quite an interesting representation of other fearful choices that I made for a long time in my life, which is that I think that wow, I'm having like an Oprah moment with you on my own podcast. This is incredibly careless. All your fans are going to be like, shut the fuck
no,
up.
No, no, no. Bring, I'm hanging on every word.
I would have rather, I'm attractive enough and I had a nice enough body that I would have rather be covered up and have people assume that I had a nicer body than reveal more of my body and show what I consider to be flaws that you wouldn't necessarily think would be there. And I think that that stands in for emotional choices that I also made with like being afraid to pursue this career because, or being afraid to overachieve or being afraid to try hard at things that I wasn't necessarily immediately good at because it was so scary to fail that I think I thought I would rather have, and I have talked about on the podcast before because a lot of us are like this, but that you'd rather have someone think, wow, if she just applied herself, she could be really great, but instead she's just pretty good at that. Instead of, oh my God, she really applied herself and she was terrible.
Failing forward.
Failing forward. So I think there was I think it took me a longer than it would, than it should have for me to finally go, you know what? Whatever.
Well, when did you get to the whatever moment, do you think?
I don't know. It wasn't until, I guess I had, I definitely was like in probably my mid-20s maybe. And there's, I don't want to misrepresent myself. I definitely was like doing a bunch of stuff and the people were like, you're weird. And I was like, I don't care. But it was all stuff I was comfortable with and that I felt safe about. So you can be, I think, the most extroverted person and make think crazy decisions and do be a maven and start trends and all that kind of stuff. I think people can do that and everyone assumes that means they have all the self-confidence of the world. All that has to mean is whatever level that they're operating on, they might be able to be so much more confident and so much more authentic, but they still aren't realizing their full potential. So somebody could be, you know, the best singer in the world, but they're not taking their chances at doing something else that they truly love. But everyone's like, oh, she's so emboldened. Look at her. He's so amazing. He's such an amazing whatever. He's such an amazing poet. But really what he wants to do is write screenplays. But he can't write. He can't let himself write screenplays. He's like, I'd rather just let everyone think I'm the best poet there is than do this thing that I'm actually terrified by that I really want to do.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so that's so in line with... I don't know, just I feel like everything that I'm going through right now, I mean, I at this part of the journey, you know what I mean? I that's just something I hope, like I hear your words and I listen to what you're saying and I think it's such great examples and I feel that I think something that I'd love to move toward and, you know, however long it takes is just the willingness. I don't feel myself circling it, but just the willingness to fail and fail forward and to be bad. You know, I've definitely become so much more interested in being flawed and terrible than being perfect. Like it was a shift. And I think a lot of it was being pregnant kind of at a younger age, like, you know, having the experience of pregnancy, which is amazing, and getting super fat, like super fat, like just like eating my way through LA. I mean, I could tell you that every sweet potato fry and lemonade stand.
Oh, I love it.
Within a 15-mile radius. And also feeling really close to the earth and really I just felt purpose for my body, and because everything is purposeful, you know, I think before, you know, having the same insecurities and also I love, you know, as women, a man that I know said recently, men look at the whole picture. They're not looking at the details. And women, we are so focused on the detailed flaws. We can't see the full picture.
Yeah.
Like it's completely opposite. And so what we don't want to do for the opposite sex is ruin the view, you know? So like, you don't want to undermine or devalue how someone else is appreciating the other form or even the view out in front of us. But, you know, I just something about being so grounded and feel, I mean, you feel it from the tips of your toes, the top of your head, that every single molecule and every single vessel in your body is being used for a purpose. Whereas before, you know, living in LA and being a mostly out of work actor, I spent so much time like working on my exterior and interior, but really just like, oh, well, what am I going to do today? You know, I'm going to work out or I'm going to, and it's so empty. Like it became so empty and so futile to me. And then when my body had purpose, just something shifted and I just got so much more okay with being a mess, you know, like just kind of being where I was and that became so much more interesting. And then the act of childbirth is so messy and so crazy that it's like, you know, I don't know, just really quote unquote opened me up to just, you know, to a whole other side of humanity and to our capability. And so, yeah, I just kind of like have been trying to move in that direction of being so much more adventurous. Like I feel it internally. I went to Costa Rica recently. My friend Perry Reeves, who is famous from Entourage, she played Ari Gold's wife on the show. She's a really, really close friend of mine, wonderful human being. And she has spent the last 7.5 years of her life as she was on Entourage building this yoga retreat called the Sanctuary at Two Rivers, which is so devastatingly beautiful and off the beaten path. You take a plane to San Jose and then you take a puddle jumper to Montezuma and then you take a truck ride 45 minutes and they drop you off at the bottom and you got to walk a mile up the hill. And it's amazing. You walk through these two beautiful rivers and it's kind of Architectural Digest meets, you know, very simple yoga retreat standards and like Costa Rica cabins in the woods. And I kind of went there for a cleansing, you know, like a jungle can hold my pain trip. And Perry was
a jungle can hold my pain.
It was.
I love it.
Totally. And Perry was kind enough. She just opened it in April. So we were the first group that went. So I went with me, myself and six friends and went, and we kind of turned it into this creative yoga, life-changing retreat and, just going down there and, like really getting messy, like really being so connected. And it's a blue zone. There's only like six in the world where people live. It's a most concentrated area where people live to over 100. And the only thing that they can connect it to is that people live in community and they say hi to each other. And, and also they're much more, the photosynthesis there is happening at a more rapid rate. And so I got to spend some time there just having an outpouring And I mentioned that because, you know, I do feel like, you know, you're just further along on the journey, whatever you're moving toward. And part of that was just moving toward and moving into the imperfection of life and moving towards, you know, the ground. I don't know. The ground is becoming so much more important to me. But I remember a shift inside me where I was like, I am less afraid of being wrong. And I remember it was like, we were on a waterfall and it was that thing where I remember before, I don't remember when before was, but it was before I would have been fearful or been more self-conscious, you know, and we're in bathing suits the whole time. And I literally had like the worst diaper rash. Like I looked like a sign when I went to Costa Rica. I looked like a sign that says "Gringos, don't come here." Like I had a sunburn and I had a diaper rash and like my hair turns, my hair like grows in volume in super humid climates of, you know, 10 times. I mean, I fro, like it was hilarious. Like that's what everyone was saying. Like you do kind of look like a poster child for do not come to Costa Rica. But then like after 3 days of adjusting and like the 20,000 mosquito bites, I was totally fine. They were like over me. Remember this moment on the waterfall where, you know, jumping over the edge, I would have had that moment of just extreme self-consciousness or kind of in a way, like my arms out, like a distance to me and the experience. And I just remember it was like so fluid. Something I didn't have the fear, like, I don't know what happened, but wherever that
Talk
was just
being
a marker.
Moment, right?
It was very present and I was a marker. I was like, okay, I just want to keep moving in that direction. I don't know exactly how I got here, but just the simple act of seeking or saying, I want that over there and I'm gonna keep moving toward, you know, messiness or imperfection or not having to be good and flaws being much more interesting to me than, you know, something seemingly perfect. You know, I was just like, okay, like, yeah, I'm going to keep moving towards that. I don't know what that means and I don't have to figure it out. I don't have to crack it. I'm not going to crack it, but I'm just enjoying moving toward it. And I think the enjoyment of the journey has been a, you know, just a revelation for me and helping me release myself from wanting to wear the too big shirt and the baggy shorts, covering up the idea, the imagination. And there's a power, very powerful, the imagination of flaws, but, you know, really wanting to wear that place inside of me that is it really about the, you know, igniting the imagination or is it about covering up my insecurity? So it's a fine line. You know?
Oh my God. We've gone so far over an hour.
Oh, we have? Oh, okay.
Comical, but I can't think of a better way to end other than that I could talk to you for two more hours. I would probably fall asleep during, we would both fall asleep. We would wake up and it would be like, it would have like looped onto itself again and erased everything. And it just would have been dead silence with maybe some snores.
By the way, we're talking to each other through a tin can.
Yeah.
Like, and she's in a she's in the house next door.
Yep. I've got my hands up, like my face propped up with my elbows on the windowsill and we're talking. Abigail, what
a
joy.
Oh my gosh. JV.
Abby.
JV. JV.
I'm so glad that I pursued you. Like I wanted to date you for this podcast because I knew this was going to be exactly what it was. And guys, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I found it ridiculously inspiring and gently inspiring. Like Yvette Nicole Brown's episode, which will have come out also recently. It was a big hit too. It was very like fiery, inspiring, like and this feels like beautiful, like introspective, sit with the feelings that it stirs up for you and really let the inspiration kind of whisper itself in your ear. And I just think that that's it's been a really special episode. So
it comes from you. Thanks for igniting this whole, you know, these talks. It's super wonderful. And again,
I get so much out of it. I mean, I'm basically getting therapy for free.
Amazing. Okay. Well, I'm going to point you in the direction of someone much more qualified than I, but, you know, thank you. And I'm so glad we met through Burning Love.
Too.
I mean, who would have thunk that this little like 8-day exploration in,
I know. We could start a whole weird Burning Love movement based on like how great all the women are.
I think some people would be really happy about that.
You're probably right. All right, guys. Well, thanks so much. And thanks again, Abby. And we'll see you next time on the podcast. The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.